Build a polished wardrobe that shows you stay you wherever you go with Mack Weldon. Use code MACK25 for 25% off your first order of $125 or more at MackWeldon.com.
Not just us, not just Black people, Americans, not forget who we are, the good, the bad, the ugly, and the hopeful. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, and this is Justice by Design. There is a question that can be uncomfortable for anyone, but I think it resonates in a particular way for Black women. Who do you think you are? It's a question that is often pregnant with mischaracterization and stereotypes and assumptions. It's a question that's meant to often be a reminder of where you are and whether or not people think that you belong there. But it's a question that is at the center of a new book that is written by my guest today, who I'm happy is here with me, because I think it opens the door to answering a lot of questions about what we are seeing happening, playing out in the United States and across the world right now. And my guest today is Martha Jones, who is the author of The Trouble of Color, an American family memoir. She's also an historian at Johns Hopkins University and a friend of mine. Martha, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Kim. It's an honor to be here, really.
So tell us about the origin story of this memoir, about you and your family, The Trouble of Color, and how you set out to answer that very question. Who do you think you are?
Well, that is the question, isn't it? And the book opens with a scene from my past. It's 1976. I'm a first year in college. I am a psychology major and a Black studies minor. And I am green, as we say, which is to say, it is my first time away from home. It is my first time really stepping fully into questions and explorations of Black life. And I give an oral presentation, as we do. I'll date myself by emphasizing I have index cards in front of me, not an iPad. And my hands are shaky, but I'm presenting on a very distinguished text, Frantz Fanon's A Dying Colonialism. And I'm not very far into the presentation when a classmate stands up and challenges me. Not so much about my interpretation of the book, though there is that, really puts on the table a question. Someone like me, someone who looks like me, who appears to be perhaps not quite fitting in a Black studies classroom, who do I think I am to be speaking? Particularly about someone as esteemed as Fanon. And it's a, it's a deeply unsettling moment. Remember, I'm first year in college, and so I'm pretty untested. But on the other hand, it's an important question, because this is a classmate who lets me know that as I move into the world, folks are going to not only have questions about me, I think to your opening point, they are not going to be timid oftentimes about those questions, and that I should expect to be queried, to be challenged as I go forward to make my way in the world. And that is a sobering lesson, but it's a true lesson at the same time, I think.
Yeah. And so this spurred you to do an exploration of your own family's history, which is really wonderful and beautifully written. Why take that path, because, you know, there's also a part of me, if I were confronted with questions like that, to say, you know what, it's none of your business. I don't have to prove myself. So what is the purpose then of making this exploration of your family's history?
Yeah, I think even in that moment, I think what I really desire or need is understanding, right? And that, you know, the quick retort just isn't going to get me there. But I also don't have, and I know the answer to his question. The answer is family, right? That I come from a Black family. I come from many, many generations of Black families, as I try and map out in the book. And I want him to understand that. But nobody, whether it's in a classroom or it's at a cocktail party or it's, you know, in an elevator, wherever you might encounter someone who has questions about who you are, most people really aren't looking for you to begin to, you know, narrate your family past. So it takes me a long time, and it takes me becoming someone who writes books to really have the space and the skills to answer his question in the way I needed to answer it, which was to visit these generations and to tell him and to tell readers something about the people I come from and how, as the book title suggests, the trouble of color is not only the trouble in my life, but it has been a source of trouble, if you will, for many, many of the folks that I come from.
Yeah. You know, it's really amazing because at reading it, I was thinking a lot about how I've moved through the world as a Black woman. And even with that, when there have been discussions, you know, me being a political and legal reporter over issues like immigration, and there was a period of time, I remember maybe a while ago, maybe about a decade ago, when Republicans were really proposing some really stringent immigration policies. And there was this idea, there was this phrase, it's like, we are all immigrants. We are all immigrants. And I remember getting back when I was still on Twitter, getting on Twitter is like, I'm not an immigrant. Like, I get the point, but there's a way to show support for being a welcoming country without erasing a certain segment of the population. I am not an immigrant. Or if I criticize policies publicly, I am told by, you know, in response, we'll go back to where you came from. And I'm like, listen, my family, I've traced it back to at least 1699 that my family has been on U.S. soil. So where am I supposed to go? I feel like there's a fundamental lack of understanding about the Black American experience more in a larger way, but certainly a lack of understanding about individual Black experiences and the experiences of individual families. And for our listeners of the podcast who are not watching on YouTube, the basis of this is Martha is a beautiful woman. Her skin is paler. Her hair is straighter than mine. And that's part of the reason why people's assumptions about her might be a little different about assumptions about me, but race permeates it nonetheless. It's just really amazing. And I just don't think that's something that, you know, our white brothers and sisters understand, because they haven't moved in the space where they have to explain themselves, explain who they think they are, the same way you and I have, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. And it takes me to, you know, I think one of the things I learned in writing this book is how much context, as we say, or time and place matters. How I understand myself in a 21st century world in which I teach young people who have categories like mixed race and biracial available to them. Well, I'm of the one drop generation, as we say. Yeah. And those kinds of ideas didn't exist. But it's true also that I come from people who were so-called mulatto in their own time, colored in other moments. I come from enslaved people who are part of very complicated family scenes that not only cross the color line, but cross lines of status, families that are comprised of enslaved people and slaveholders. This is not my 21st century idea about family, but it was an important and a consequential idea about family in the 19th century. So I think there's a way in which I hope the book, you know, really foregrounds for us when we encounter one another, when we hear one another's family stories, a reminder that the American family has never been monolithic or pure or lived along classical lines of a family tree, that the American family has been and continues to be in its own way, I think, a much more complicated, sometimes troubling, sometimes interesting and exciting, configuration of humans. And rather than write out that complexity, for me, it was important to sort of try and embrace that complexity and then see what I thought about what it meant to be family.
So I think that's a great segue to talk about some of the issues that are playing out right now in America, the idea of what an American family is on that intersection. And I'm thinking, of course, right off the top of my head about the attempt to strip birthright citizenship from people who are born on U.S. soil when their parents are present in the country without federal authorization. I think people don't realize that the citizenship clause in the Constitution was put in there for Black people. It was put in to ensure that people like my 3x great-grandfather, who was born into enslavement, but who found his way from Mississippi to Kentucky somehow to enlist in the Union Army and fight in the Civil War for his freedom, that his children and everyone right down to me would be considered a citizen of this country. But talk about how, as a historian, as someone who studied your own family and this idea of being an American, what insight can you give as to why there is an attack right now on birthright citizenship? And even though it's not aimed at Black Americans, it's very much a Black American story.
It indeed is. And we owe the terms of the 14th Amendment, that amendment that constitutionalizes birthright citizenship, the regime under which we continue to live as Americans today. We owe that to the struggles back in the beginning of the 19th century of Black Americans. Some of them enslaved, but many of them free people who understand that without the status of citizen, they are, and I hope this, we hear the resonances of our own time, they were subject to removal from the United States through a movement that was called back in the day colonization. Colonizationists organized to remove Black Americans, free Black Americans from the U.S. to places like Liberia in the interest of preserving the nation as a white man's country. And that is their language, not ours. So when we sit in the 21st century and we contemplate the abrogation of birthright by this administration, whether it comes by executive order or act of Congress or ultimately from the courts, it is important to remember that we are not only undoing an abstract principle, a powerful one, and that's important, but we are also undoing generations of Black American lives, struggle, activism, and vision for what a democracy might really be in this country. And so the stakes are high for us because I would say there's a way in which the challenge to this amendment is another kind of erasure of Black history. And we're seeing Black history erased by so many means. This is, I think, one more example of just that.
As a professor, an academic, a historian, when you see those efforts at erasure, which is exactly what it is, whether it's DEI programs within the federal government, whether it is attacks on universities, including the one on one of my alma maters, Columbia University, which I'm very disappointed in their decision to fold against that, to this idea that critical race theory was a threat to elementary schoolers. How do you see that? I mean, if in order for the current administration to seem successful, why is it, in your opinion, that this attack is necessary for them to achieve their goals? They're claiming that they want to make everything fair, but erasing Black people, not just Black people of color, women, other people, their very achievements in particular. Why do you see that erasure as a central value in the current administration?
Well, I think in part because it is a twisted testament, right, to the power of history, right, to inform and guide and set the bar high for who we might be as a nation. What do you do with something like a 14th Amendment? One of the bedrocks of our modern Constitution, when you have to ascribe that vision to Black Americans, that tells us something powerful, I think something true, but something powerful and unsettling for folks who I think still subscribe in their own way to those old tenets that the American Colonization Society promoted, right? That this is a white man's nation. It may be populated, people of color and women and others may do the labor as we have done for this country. We may do the heavy lifting, but leadership, you know, thought, you know, power, that I think we're seeing the resurfacing of the colonizationists' logic, so much so that one prong of the 21st century scheme, as we are seeing it unfold now, is the removal of Americans, right? Is the disruption of families. That was precisely the colonizationists' scheme. The colonizationists hoped that Black folks would self-deport because they understood that their families could not survive the assault of Black laws, the threats of deportation. And so I can say for someone like me, the parallels are not only eerie, they are heart-stopping because if I could just bring it back to the trouble of color, you know, I have a great-great-grandmother who is enslaved up through the Civil War. She has three children, and her so-called owner dies. And now she's subject to an estate proceeding. And what she knows is that, as was true for so many, many of us, families are torn asunder in estate proceedings. Children are separated from parents. Siblings are separated from one another. She lives with that kind of terror alongside this pressure that she should just agree to become a free person so that she can be exported to Liberia. Well, when I recall, as I think we all are called upon to do in this moment, when I recall that facet of our own history, I think we see the ways in which, you know, as we sometimes say, the playbook, right, the violence of today's playbook is really returning to something we have known, and it, something that is now being visited on families that are being reduced to their status as immigrants in this country. It is an eerily familiar approach to how to make this a white man's country.
Yeah, you know, in thinking about the erasure and the erasure of history, I remember, I think it was 10, 12 years ago, that PBS did a really wonderful documentary series about Reconstruction. And the number of people who did not know that Reconstruction even happened, people who studied history, American history, all this, were unaware that after the Civil War, there was a period of time where Black people were being elected to Congress. Black people were building communities. They had their own banks. They had their own, they were represented not just in Congress, but at all levels of local and state government. And it really was a supported effort by the federal government to help people, help Black people, not just get citizenship, not just be called Americans, but to function in America like Americans, and how Jim Crow completely wiped that out in the most brutal of ways. And then subsequently, history was rewritten to erase that at all. I mean, even now, even the last few years with the Tulsa massacre, people did not realize it was a Black Wall Street in Oklahoma. So what's happening now is similar to that. We've had advancements, and since the election of Barack Obama, we have seen this backlash. This is a continuation of that pendulum swing. So how do we stop that? How, as a historian, how do we preserve our history so that we don't forget who we are? Not just us, not just Black people, Americans, not forget who we are, the good, the bad, the ugly, and the hopeful.
Yeah. You know, one answer for me in this moment is about our family stories. Right, is gathering those up, passing those down, that we are charged with being the keepers of our own past. And what that means for some of us is, you know, going through the letters and the diaries and the photographs and beginning to make some sense out of who people were and what they did and what it meant. You know, for others of us, it means interviewing elders and getting their stories down. People just take out your iPhone today and, you know, and hit a button and you can, you know, be the keeper of those stories. We have always been the keeper of our own history. I've been thinking a lot these days about the great Carter G. Woodson, the Harvard educated Black historian who cannot find his footing in the mainstream academy. Well, Woodson creates the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History. He creates the Journal of Negro History. He creates Black History Week, which becomes Black History Month. Remembering that we have never left the project of our history in the hands of the state. The state sometimes, as you say, can be an ally. Certainly that was true during Reconstruction's great experiment in interracial democracy. I certainly am someone who will never forget the role that the Obamas played in surfacing Black history, including, you know, Mrs. Obama's deep commitment to the history of Black Americans and the very building of the White House, for example. But we have always been, I think, the agents and the keepers and the promoters of our own history. And we are being called back to that purpose in this moment. And so for someone like me, whose work is research and writing, the archive, the book, and more, it is to double down, triple down on that commitment, and to recall that we come out of a tradition that was never given license by anyone in Washington. We authorized ourselves to do that work.
What advice do you give in pulling that history together? Because I, when I began doing that, I guess maybe a little over a decade ago now, going through records. So for a long time, there was a, even as there was a genealogy craze, remember in like the early 2000s, everybody was like getting their, you know, going, yeah, doing their family trees. And I was hesitant to even begin because I thought, okay, I'm going to hit a wall. Like, I'm going to get someplace in the mid 1800s and it's going to be And I was actually surprised once I actually did do it, how many records, depending on where people were, depending on the states and how well states took what records, how far back I could go, and the interesting things that I found. And even when I discussed it with some members of my family, they didn't want to. They didn't want to go there. They know that it's painful, that it's brutal, that it's awful, and they would rather talk about the fact of where we are now or where we came recently, the fact that, you know, talk about assumptions. People ask me, or were you the first one in your family to go to college? And I was like, no, sir, my grandfather was college educated, and other, you know, education has been a big value in my family. Mm-hmm. They want to focus on that, that the how far we've come and not where we come from. So it was tough. I had to kind of on my own, like kind of, you know, secretly do my own exploration. And my family is not always something that people are willing to do. What advice do you give to encourage people to know about themselves? Because I definitely can say what I've learned and I'm still learning about my family informs a great deal about who I am and my place in this country. Give some advice to others who maybe face that same sort of challenge or resistance.
Well, you know, you've already given a version of the advice, you know, which is, we can know a great deal more than we might think. We have to be dogged. I don't know about you, but I'm, you know, I'm up until 3 o'clock in the morning, bleary eyed, going through the census returns. Yes. We can know a great deal more, but there are, I think, cautions in that. One of them you've pointed to, that our elders and our ancestors told different stories than the ones we might be able to and feel called to tell. And partly in this book, I had to negotiate with them on the page because I understood that I was telling stories that others had kept to themselves. Mm. And to understand that they had kept those stories to themselves for important reasons, not because they were naive and not because they were selfish, but because they lived in a different time. And the stakes, for example, of putting on the page being the descendant of an enslaved woman who was sexually assaulted for many years, bore children. I do understand why prior generations didn't tell those stories. And at the same time, I think the other caution is that we have to wade into sources that were not created for us, right? You know, the census taker did not have us in mind when he visited, you know, my great grandparents' two-room shack in Greensboro, North Carolina. You know, he had himself in mind. He had the state in mind. He had, you know, demographics in mind. He had power in mind. But he wasn't there to collect the human details of who they were to one another. And so we have to be skeptical and critical even of those sources rather than too deferential to them. They look like they're telling you a truth because they come in an official form and they've got stamps and seals and signatures. But these two are just stories written by men who oftentimes had interests that were antithetical to the interests that our ancestors had. And we must be the keepers of their stories, of our stories, and not the keepers simply of the official stories as they were written down.
Yeah. I do take comfort in the fact that because of technology, so much more of this information is available to us to see, to scrutinize with a critical eye, as you point out very well, and are more at our fingertips. But you're absolutely right. I mean, there is something, particularly when you get to antebellum times, in seeing census records that lists my ancestors as if they are property assets. That's wild. You know, that is something that I'm not sure I was in the beginning emotionally prepared for. Mm-hmm. But it does. I'm glad that I did it. It does inform. I mean, I love that I have such stories of bravery. Like, I still don't know how my great-great-great-grandfather, Henry Crenshaw, got from a plantation in Mississippi to Louisville in order to enlist in the Union Army. How did he get there? I mean, that's one of those stories that I wish I could better uncover. And I haven't pulled all the clues from that yet. But just seeing sort of the story of migration and knowing that some of my ancestors came from Mali and other places, that's incredibly powerful to me. And I think it would be very powerful for Americans, regardless of where they come from, to understand that this experiment was maybe carried out to be that of a land that is run by and for white male landowners, but you cannot keep it as that story, regardless of efforts like we're seeing underway right now to do just that with fear and stereotypes and force in some cases, literally putting people on planes and whisking them to a different place, which is not dissimilar to putting people on boats and whisking them to a different place. And we need to be clear about what we're seeing and what it means. And I appreciate you, your work as a historian, which I call upon a lot, and I appreciate that, and your wonderful memoir, The Trouble of Color, that you've written to help us lead the way. Martha Jones, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much for having me, Kim.
You know, so much about what's happening in our politics right now is about the story that many Americans want to tell themselves about this nation, about its founding, its principles, who built it, and for whom. And I think my discussion today with Martha just brings to light how complex and beautiful and fraught and tragic and joyful and hopeful our story really is, if we dare to look truthfully at it. Doing so may make it a lot harder for certain folks to amass the type of power they want to amass, but doing so is what it really means to understand what it is to be an American and how profoundly and beautifully complex that is. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Thanks for listening to this episode of Justice by Design. You know, you can find Justice by Design wherever you listen to your podcast, so make sure you subscribe and give a 5-star review. You can also find it on YouTube, where you can watch my discussions with my guests like Martha Jones on the Politicon YouTube channel. Take good care of yourself, and I'll see you next week with another episode, Justice by Design.